Hey Caffeinators, welcome to the Vet Tech Cafe. The Vet Tech Cafe is a podcast centered around veterinary technicians and nurses, hosted by myself, Dave Cowan, and my good friend Jeff Backus. We strive to discuss current issues facing our profession and give our colleagues a voice and a medium to enter into these discussions. Our guests are experts in the veterinary field that we hope can help our listeners work towards dealing with these issues, as well as coming up with solutions that can lead to change. If you have a question, comment, or would like to be a guest on the Vet Tech Cafe, please contact us at vettechcafe@gmail.com, or you can find us at our website, vettechcafe.com. One thing we would ask of you, our listeners, is to rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you're listening to. We're not exactly sure how or why this helps us, but apparently it does. So without further ado, come on in, grab yourself a cup of coffee, and get ready for another episode of the Vet Tech Cafe.
Good morning, Caffeinators. Hope you're all doing well out there. Dave, how's it going out in North Carolina?
It's going great. It is getting a little bit chilly. It's getting more into fall. I realize up north where you were, they've been in fall/winter for the last couple weeks. I did see that it snowed up there, which I don't know if you – did you see any of that snow or did you miss it?
We missed it. I'll tell you, we had – I mean, you know, the weather nerd in me is super disappointed. Yeah. However – the reality of driving cross country and being on the road 12 days, we could not have hit it any better with the weather. There was a major snowstorm in New England the weekend after we left. There was a major snowstorm in Colorado the weekend before we got there, and most of that was gone. Like, I mean, if we'd left even like probably 2 or 3 days earlier or 2 or 3 days later, we would have been nailed somewhere along the way. Yeah. But I mean, we had great weather, great driving weather, like the entire way. And now here in Southern California, it's normal November where it's, you know, 75, 80 degrees and not a cloud to be seen for days on end. But yeah, so we were super lucky with the drive, which was really nice.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you're getting settled in there. It feels like it's been forever since we've had an episode, but it's only been a couple of weeks, really.
It really has. I was just thinking this morning. It blows my mind. It's almost been 3 weeks since we actually were together and did that live.
At your
farm. And that was almost three weeks ago Monday. Like, it's crazy that's already come and gone so long. But you got a good cup of coffee out there?
I do. I got my iced coffee. I'm almost done with it because, you know, it's about noon now. Oh, it's actually 1:30 here now. But yeah, I've been doing stuff on the farm and getting ready for my day, getting ready for my weekend.
Right on. I have a cup of it's from Door County Coffee, which is in Wisconsin. If anybody likes to like mail order coffee, their coffee is phenomenal. But this is bourbon barrel pound cake.
Oh, wow.
It is so good.
That sounds super sweet.
It's on the sweeter side, but it's super good. Well, what do you think? Should we go ahead and get started? We got a little bit of a different format today.
Yeah, this is kind of not what we normally do. And we were debating on, like, are we going to release this as our own episode? Should we call it a bonus episode? But I think we decided to release it as a Vet Tech Cafe episode, even though it's far longer than our normal episodes. This is almost an hour and a half long. So yeah, this is a good episode.
Yeah, and it's a little bit less of an interview format and a little bit more of just kind of discussion points and kind of talking about it with our friends over at VetFolio and specifically Dr. Cassie. And we just kind of picked a topic and just kind of talked about it from her end on the veterinarian side, from our end on the technician side, and kind of how we can meet in the middle and work together. And
it's great to work through some of these things and kind of just have that open discussion about what do we think about this? How do we fix this?
Right, for sure. And I mean, there's so much more we could talk about. I think we'll probably do this again in the future.
Oh, yeah.
Because we got through three or four discussion points, which we'll mention in a bit. But there were so many topics we didn't even get to that we could touch on later on. So
I think we hit like the main ones wanted to talk about.
For sure, we did. Yeah. So in case you guys aren't familiar, Dr. Cassie over at VetFolio, she's a veterinarian. She got her master's degree in animal sciences from the University of Florida, followed by her DVM from University of Florida as well in 2014. She currently practices at a small animal general practice in North Central Florida. Loves dentistry and geriatric medicine, and specifically pain management for those guys. She's also VetFolio staff veterinarian, which has afforded her some opportunities to really network and kind of have meeting of the minds in veterinary medicine, and really try to generate change. When she's not working, she loves spending time with her husband, Josh, their two young daughters, and her dogs, and basically anything outside. But Dave, in this episode, we talk about utilization, yeah. wages, turnover, whether or not unicorn clinics exist. So we kind of cover a lot. It's a bit of a longer episode than we normally have, but it's just really a great discussion that I certainly learned a lot from. I know you did too. And again, we look forward to doing it again.
Well, and I think one of the reasons that we did this, but one of the great parts of this is that Dr. Fleming was also a former vet assistant.
Yes.
Doing stuff that technicians do, which is a gray area that we kind of gloss over.
Yeah.
All too frequently, but getting her perspective from being on both sides of the situation, I think was really helpful.
Right.
Because she saw it in terms of how does this field look from the doctor's side? How does it look from the technician side? And I think that was great to get kind of somebody who's on both sides of that issue.
Right, for sure. And then, of course, through this collaboration came some really, really great opportunities for the caffeinators that are listening. They were really, really generous with some giveaways and subscriptions. And so we're going to have a couple of giveaways this week. But first, we'll want to say through the end of the year, so through December 31st, you can use the code VetTechCafe 2020 on Vetfolio, and you can get 25% discount on any of their three NAVC certifications, which are the Human Animal Bond, Pet Nutrition, and Certified Business Leader. So that's super cool.
Well, it's also for the yearly subscription too.
Yeah. So there's individual subscriptions, there's practice subscriptions. So if you haven't been to Vetfolio and you're looking, especially everybody's looking for virtual CE in 2020, hopefully in 2021 we can maybe think about getting back to having some live, but in the event it's getting to the end of the year, if you're still looking for CE hours, check out Vetfolio, use the code VetTechCafe 2020 for a 25% discount.
And they have hundreds of courses.
So much information available there. So that's really awesome. And then the other thing, Dave, is we're going to have two giveaways this week from them. We have the first one we're going to do. So we're going to have an Instagram post with the episode released tomorrow night on Sunday. Of course, when you listen to this, it will be Sunday. So today.
Right.
We're going to give away first one of the free certifications. So the cost of the certification will be completely free.
Certifications, there's the Human Animal Bond, Pet Nutrition, and then the last one is Certified Business Leader. So I think all those are kind of things that would be really helpful, in veterinary practices.
For sure. And so to be entered in the drawing, all you have to do is like that post that we make, and of course follow the Vet Tech Cafe. Follow Vetfolio on Instagram. It's at Vetfolio. In case you're not familiar, it's VetFolio. And then subscribe to both podcasts. They do a podcast as well. We'll go through and verify who liked the post and then meets all the certifications or meets all the requirements. And then on Wednesday, we'll give away that subscription, and we'll contact you directly. And then probably that night, I think, Dave, we'll start another giveaway, and this is going to be a free 1-year subscription to all of Vetfolio, which is incredible. I think it's over $500
for the practice subscription is over $500. I think an individual one is about $300. This is a huge
value.
Giveaway.
And so we're gonna make another post on Wednesday, start a new drawing, and then probably as it gets later in the week, maybe next weekend, we'll actually get together and we'll do an Instagram live and we'll announce the winner at that point in time. So,
because that's a huge value. That's amazing.
For sure. So huge thank you to Vetfolio, not only for allowing us to involve you guys listening and offer you some really, really cool stuff. The CE discount, the 25% discount is huge in its own right.
Yeah.
But then the two giveaways for subscription and the membership or the certification. But then also just to have this dialogue and have this episode.
Yeah.
And it's the first veterinarian that we've talked to about some of these issues, and it won't be the last.
Nope.
You know, we've got a few others we want to talk to about some of these same things. But huge thank you to them for kind of helping bring this full circle and involving us in it and letting us be a part of it and letting all of our listeners be a part of it. I think it's going to be good going forward. I know I certainly enjoyed it.
And they're also going to post this on their, because they have a podcast as well.
Yeah.
So they're going to post this same episode on their platform as well.
Yes, yes.
Just with a little different intro about you and
about
I,
Jeff. Us. So, yeah, from them. So,
which is kind of interesting to hear
for sure,
her take
for sure.
on our bios.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to check that out. So I think, when are they releasing that?
They are releasing theirs on the 19th, I believe.
The 19th, okay, yeah. So we'll be out.
So they're going to be later in the week. We're going to be, well, if you're listening to this, now.
yeah, I think theirs is going to come out on Thursday. So so super cool. Again, check them out. Tons of really great opportunities available on their site. Tons of great info on their Instagram page. So thank you again to Vetfolio. Hope all the caffeinators are well. Dave, what do you say? Should we all go ahead and roll this episode out?
Yeah, let's get it out there because they've got another 90 minutes to listen to after this.
Yes. Enjoy your day, everybody. Thanks, caffeinators, and we'll talk to you again soon.
All right, we're so excited to be talking today to Jeff and Dave from Vet Tech Cafe. Thank you guys so much for agreeing to do this podcast together.
Oh, we're happy to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for inviting us. This is going to be so much fun.
Yes, absolutely. I've been looking forward to it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, what do you think? Should we just get started and go right in?
Absolutely.
All right. So I think what we're going to talk a lot about today is just a lot of the issues that our profession is facing. And what do you think? Where do you guys want to start off with? Maybe technician utilization?
I think that's a good point. A good starting point.
All right.
I recently had somebody correct me when I said technician utilization. And they said, you know, you utilize your pulse ox. You don't utilize people. You empower technicians.
Okay.
What's your feeling on that?
I'd never heard of that. That does make sense, but I think we hear that term and we use that a lot of technician utilization of, and kind of what it means to me is using us as valuable members of the team. And you know, speaking personally from when I was a young baby tech, very early on 20 years ago, we were just glorified warm bodies that would help hold animals for the doctors. And, you know, it wasn't until after a group of the technicians said, you know, there's stuff that we can do. And our doctors started to say, okay, this is how you intubate. And this is the other things that you can do as technicians. And it took us actually going to our doctors and saying, why are we just sitting there holding animals for you to do stuff to? We should be more involved. And I think that's kind of just the very beginning stages of things. And as things have progressed, you know, here we are 20 years later, and we're still looking for that validation of what we can actually do. I will say it's better, but we still have some work to do.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, utilization, yes, I love the idea of empowering your technicians, but I think the utilization comes from utilizing their skills and knowledge.
Sure.
You know, not just utilizing, you know, the person to do tasks or whatever. And, you know, the amount of training or the amount of education that they may have obviously is highly variable, but the utilization to me comes from, you know, being able to perform tasks or whether it be talking to clients or doing procedures or whatever it may be to free up the veterinarian to do things that really by law, they are the only ones in the practice allowed to do. And so, you know, when you look at, you know, I come from California where our practice act is I'll say pretty rigid. It's pretty explicit what can and cannot be done. And really there's four things that only a veterinarian can do, which is, you know, surgery, which is pretty well defined, diagnose, prognose, and prescribe medications. Outside of that, you know, it's the comfort level of who you have around you that you and what trust you have in them and their ability to do all of these things to free you up to be able to see more people or, you know, do the things that we cannot do. And so, you know, utilization really becomes a two-way street. By utilizing us, then you can utilize the skills that only you can perform or a veterinarian can perform in a practice.
Sure. You know, plus something to be said with kind of this universal terminology that we've used for a long time, that it has kind of a familiar meaning to a lot of people. And I like what you said about the four things that only veterinarians can do. I think it's really important that we continue to remind people of that a credentialed technician, obviously very state to state, but really can legally do a lot of things that I think sometimes that we forget, that as veterinarians, I think it's pretty universal, even with the variation state to state. The four things that are limited to only veterinarians are exactly what you said: diagnosing, prognosing, surgery, and prescribing. And then we really need to let off the reins and let the people around us do what they're trained to do and what they love to do.
Yeah.
Well, not to go down a rabbit hole so early, but
that's what we're here to do.
Jeff brings up a good point of there are so many varying levels of education and skills and knowledge amongst the team members, not just doctors, but also with technicians and technically assistants or what have you. And it must be frustrating for doctors to come into a practice that you don't really know the team all that well. And you do have that big varying level of skills within that practice and not knowing like, what can you do? Like, what do you know how to do? Because right. There are so many things or so many different levels of people that I don't want to say that are allowed to work in the field as technicians. But there's such a varying level of skill level and experience level and knowledge level to say, okay, I'm going to come in. This dog needs a central line. Which of my 12 technicians can do that? And which of you 12 are actually technicians that are trained at that? And you know, you may have somebody that performs the functions of a technician that can draw blood, that can run blood work, can run a urine sample, even obtain a urine sample. But then there is that also other part of that where some of those more advanced skills, you don't know who's even able to do that based on, like, is this the first time you're ever placing a central line? Do we need this right now? Or do we have some time to like train you to do this on the fly? And I think that varying level of education and knowledge and experience is very difficult to manage as a doctor, kind of going through these things and trying to figure out who can actually do these things.
I think you make a good point, and I appreciate you letting us as DVMs off the hook a little bit there, because working as a relief vet, as I have for the last year or so, a couple years, you're right. There is a huge variation in the skill levels of the people that you're working with, and so as much as it is important to make sure that we're allowing the people around us to do what they are able to do, you do sometimes have to go in there with, you know, feeling like, okay, if something can't, if there's nobody in here with this skill level to do this, then it's going to fall back to me. And so that can make it hard to let go and say, okay, I'm going to let you go ahead and do this, if you don't have that comfort level with the team to say, okay, I know who knows how to do what and what that comfort level is, what that right. skill level is.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think for me as well, and we've talked a little bit about this on our show a couple of different times, that, you know, I think some of this goes back to how veterinarians are trained in school. So I just finished up 4 years working in academia, and I'll say, you know, there are some departments better than others that are good at utilizing technicians, some not so much, but I was kind of surprised at how little a vet school functions like an animal hospital that a veterinarian is going to work at when they leave school. There are a lot of students, or actually, I guess really all students, are essentially utilized in a way of free labor for a lot of things, for patient treatments, for what have you. And I think that a great time to actually train veterinarians on how to utilize the staff is when they're in school. And I think we're missing the boat there by and large, based on, again, just my experience in academia and a couple other people I've talked to as well, that we almost aren't training them to be ready to go into a hospital and know the roles of all the different people that are there and the functions that those people in those roles can do, what it means to be a credentialed technician and what the difference is. And you know, I think in a really substantial way, we're kind of missing the boat there in a way, again, to the whole point of veterinarians going to vet school, right, is training and learning and knowledge. And I think we're missing a huge section of that. And it's kind of inadvertent, not that we have to have classes about, you know, how to function in an animal hospital, but if the vet school the teaching hospital itself were to function more as a as an actual practice would, and you know, not have the student do all of these things that receptionists would do or client service representatives would do, like answer the phones or you know, do patient treatments like technicians normally do, and actually kind of just set the example of how it should be. I think that could really, really go a long way. But as technicians, you know, how do we work on that, or how do we fix that? That unfortunately has to be done by the AVMA, and we don't have a seat at the table. So, you know, but I think that's one area where we could really make some substantial improvements, and that would naturally, again, kind of over time, really help solve some of that problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Of, you know, just learning what the different roles are in the hospital. I think the intention behind having students do a lot of these things is good, you know, to give DVMs a familiarity with the different roles throughout the hospital. But you're right, it might put us a little bit into that mentality of, I have to do all of these things, it's all my responsibility, versus, you know, it's a good idea to understand the different roles. But as part of that understanding, figuring out how you work as a team and how you rely on each other, and everybody gets to play a role in the practice.
Right. Yeah.
I do somewhat agree with the way the schools are running now. Is, Jeff, you say we should be treating these animal hospitals like we would normally do that in school, and utilizing technicians and utilizing credentialed technicians. However, there are practices out there that don't have RVTs. They don't have LVTs. So I do kind of understand why doctors need to get training on some of those things, because like you said, Cassie, there may be times where you get into a practice and you're the only one that knows how to do that one thing. So I do somewhat understand having doctors learn that stuff. However, if they didn't have to, they could spend so much time learning other things that are more important.
Right. And I think that's it, is learning the value of having those people and having those people on staff. And, you know, it feeds into so much other things, or so many other things that we're going to talk about today. You know, all of these topics are all kind of intertwined. And, you know, it's a multifaceted problem with lots of probably very complicated solutions.
Yeah.
That's okay. We're going to solve it right
here. Oh, we're solving it today. Awesome. Awesome.
Yes.
But I mean, we've always said, you know, you can't start to fix a problem if you don't start talking about it. So just starting to talk about it, I think hopefully we'll, you know, I don't know how our reach is not huge. We don't have a massive reach, but we do have some reach, and you have some reach. So hopefully we can reach out to some people and maybe get people talking about this and getting more change involved.
Yeah, I think we need to talk about it, and we need to keep talking about it, because I think there are some real issues here. Just as illustrated by our exchange up to this point of different ideas, these are major issues that we need to address. I mean, we have problems with longevity in the field, and, you know, burnout, stress, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So like you said, the first step is to start talking about it and have people understand where these problems lie, and let's start brainstorming. And just because it's always been a certain way doesn't mean it has to stay that way.
Right.
We always say, just because that's the way you've always done it doesn't mean that it was always right.
Yes.
Right. Right.
Yes.
That a lot. Yeah. Or, I mean, you should change and adapt and improve as new things come out and, you know, knowledge is gained and so on.
We do that in medicine, right?
I mean, right.
We change and adapt. So this is part of medicine, is you change and adapt to the culture as well.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, kind of thinking about this again as like a multifaceted problem, you know, one of the things that also kind of goes in there too is pay. And, you know, it's pretty well established. I think both professions, the technician profession and the veterinarian profession, are largely underpaid and certainly better in some areas than others. But again, I think if you have, you know, well-educated and well-trained staff members, veterinarians, associate veterinarians, whoever it may be in the practice, they need to be adequately compensated. But, you know, a term I hear a lot these days is living wage. And to be honest, I don't even honestly know if I know a definition of a living wage. You know, it almost to me in some ways kind of sounds like a buzzword, you know, because what a living wage where I am now in Rhode Island versus where I'll be in Southern California in 2 weeks are two very different numbers.
Very different numbers.
And so, you know, but then again, you know, we talked, Dave, you kind of mentioned a little bit about the almost kind of alluded to like a technician shortage where there might be areas where veterinarians don't have, you know, don't have an RVT or something on staff. If we make this a sustainable career financially, you know, will that help alleviate that problem? I think the answer is yes. But again, how do we get there?
Right.
And yeah, I'm really interested to hear just where you guys fall on this and your thoughts on it. Because of course, on the DVM side, we have our own set of financial issues. From what I personally have encountered, and you know, I know finances are a sensitive topic, so I am by no means speaking for everyone, but for me personally, I've struggled more with interest rates on student loans, making them nearly impossible to pay back rather than the wage themselves. So the wages themselves, I think, are, you know, livable, let's say, you know, that living wage, we'll use that buzzword in a lot of cases, but not when there's this huge student loan burden with really high interest rates to try to pay back. So I think there's a difference. And again, like I said, I know this is a sensitive topic, so I definitely want to specify I'm speaking, you know, just from personal experience. But I think there's a difference between DVMs and technicians when it comes to the financial side of things. So I'm really interested to hear your thoughts and how this is, how it affects you.
Yeah. I guess I would say, you know, so I'm 25 years in clinical medicine. I felt like in terms of, and hold a VTS credential. And I felt like in terms of clinics, wherever, whatever market I happen to be in, I'm probably at the top of the wage earning scale in clinical medicine. So, and thankfully, again, I started long enough ago. I think I was actually trying to remember the other day for this particular recording. I think my starting wage in this field was $5 an hour.
Oh my goodness.
And of course that was 25 years ago. But then I was thinking where I am now, I don't even know if that's not even a dollar per hour a year increase.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's still, you know, a long ways to go. And Dr. Cassie, I can kind of relate to your point as well. My wife is a veterinarian. She just graduated. She was a V18. And so, you know, again, being a sensitive topic, but I'm going to throw some numbers out. She graduated vet school, $350,000 in student debt.
Oh my goodness.
And then she did a 1 year rotating internship that paid her, I think, $35,000 for the year. And I don't know if you did an internship, but anybody that's listening that certainly has, you understand it was probably 60 to 80 hour work weeks. So she was making probably single dollars per hour if you actually, you know, calculated that out. And then of course, you know, the stress of a really crazy busy referral practice and trying to figure out how to do medicine and all of those things. Like 1 year in, she's already wondering if it's all going to be worth it, you know? And then she did a second level internship for her second year. And so it's, you know, the burden, you know, and I'm only kind of experiencing it secondhand, but, for graduating veterinarians, I cannot comprehend some of those numbers. And I mean, I'm staring at the papers and I still can't comprehend it. So, you know, it's again, a multifaceted problem and I don't know how to make vet school less expensive. I don't know how to magically, you know, increase pay, but that is a massive disparity.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I did not do an internship and not the entire decision, but there was definitely a part of that that was a financial decision mm-hmm. for me mm-hmm. To know that I was going to be going another year, 2 years, you know, however, right. wherever that took me with a lower, you know, such a low wage in comparison, probably, right. you know, half.
Right.
and what that was going to do to my student loans. Although, you know, in hindsight, I don't know that I made a huge dent in them anyway. but yeah, part of my decision at the time was a financial, a financial decision.
Yeah, absolutely. I know many of her classmates, friends of ours that made the exact same decision, you know, just to go out into practice because they thought they could get the same training and mentorship that way and not go through the burdens of an internship. And I completely understand. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And Jeff, I'm kind of in the same spot. I think my first veterinary job, I was making maybe $8 an hour, but still obviously 20 some odd years ago. And I would say that I'm also at that point where I've probably maxed out what I'm ever going to make as a technician. And I've been thinking about this a lot because, you know, as I progressed as a technician, as I got better and I passed the VTNE and passed my VTS boards and gained all these skills and took on all these new roles and all these other jobs within the practice. I think, you know, where I was up in New Hampshire, my longevity in that practice, like I was in that practice for a good 10 plus years. And I think that's probably a big portion of why I got to the level where I've made. And in the last 4.5 years since I moved down here, I've changed jobs roughly 3 times. I'm about to change jobs a 4th time. Spoiler alert. This will probably post after that's announced. So
do they know that?
they don't yet, but I mean, some people do, but sure. not my students. But you know, I've changed jobs roughly almost every other year as a technician down here, and I have not made any more money. My pay has been pretty much the same since I left New Hampshire 4.5 years ago. Like I have not made a cent more. I'm actually making less right now. So, you know, there is a cap to what we can make. And, you know, unfortunately for me, I hit that cap 5 years ago and I'm left wondering, like, I'm at the point where some other younger technicians are making, you know, $10, $11 an hour thinking, am I ever going to make more money? And I'm at that same boat, even though I'm making way more than that. And not to say, you know, using this term livable wage. Yeah. I have more responsibilities now. I have more costs now. I have more certifications that I need to keep up with now because I've advanced myself that far. So yeah, the money is a big thing. And I can't speak to the point of some of the other technicians because Jeff and I are kind of at the top of what we will make. But there's, I mean, younger technicians, newer technicians, I can't tell you how many of them are working 2 jobs right now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're making that livable wage by combining sometimes two full-time jobs together just to make it and to pay rent and buy food and afford car insurance and all this other stuff. And it's to the point where, yeah, this job is, there's no wonder there's so much turnover because it's not sustainable.
Yeah. It's not sustainable. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm nodding my head going, I've seen it firsthand. You know, I lived it for a period of time. I worked as a technician, technically, an assistant. I say technician cause I'm in Florida, where credentialing is not required, but, so technically I was an assistant at, the University of Florida for a while. And, you know, I saw it so much as far as not being sustainable in the long term. And my husband still sees it. He does human resources over there and we try to solve this problem on a regular basis and we still haven't gotten to the bottom of it. But I think these are a lot of the major issues, the utilization, the pay. And then you guys also mentioned staff turnover being a big issue. I know that's a huge source of frustration from a veterinarian's perspective. And I know it is from yours as well. You know, I always look at it. I rely heavily on my team when I'm in the clinic. I always feel like I'm just one person and I'm only human. I'm so fortunate to have this team of people here to support me. And I can't tell you how many times, you know, I'm just kind of like steeled against it because you get that team that you trust and y'all, you know, everybody's in support of each other. But due to that lack of sustainability, all of a sudden you lose one person or you lose more. And people are forced to pick up additional responsibilities, which leads to that stress. And there's still the pay issue. And, you know, here we go through this roller coaster that happens over and over and over again. And it's, I get it. It's frustrating, but I get it.
Yeah. I would say, I think, you know, again, not to, to make light of the first two issues that we talked about, but I think if ever we as a profession were to get the utilization and the pay figured out, the turnover would naturally work itself out. Like, I think this is one that I don't know that we can solve without solving some of the other things. But I will say too, in my time at Tufts, you know, we, like, students turnover every year. It's a new set of students on clinics. It's a new class of interns. You know, there's always residents coming and going every year. So other than faculty, we don't have staff doctors. And so turnover is just such a natural part of the environment. And I don't know if it's that spills over to technicians. I also know that, you know, our vet school and probably several others, promote, assistance to the title of veterinary technician that aren't credentialed. And that's, you know, that's administration. That's fundamental, right? That's not on the students or the faculty or anything like that. But when we get back to like turnover and stuff, I felt like where I was, turnover was just such a natural thing because everybody in the hospital was doing that. I almost felt like there was no desire to keep long tenured or well-educated or well-credentialed staff because turnover was just such a natural thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I started there, I was a group of a couple of different technicians that were hired specifically for the emergency and critical care department. And while I don't have the numbers, I strongly feel like when I left, which my last shift was just a couple of weeks ago, we were at a net loss of people from where I started 4 years ago. I mean, we had 6 or 8 open positions when I gave my notice. And we just, you know, there's a couple people that we've hired that have stayed, but there's not, you know, there's already so many people that have come in and we have a really, really great tech school program nearby that's still one of the few tech programs that has a fully functioning animal hospital on site. So they get a lot of in-hospital training, these veterinary technician students, and we get a lot of employees from them. And just in my time alone, I know technicians that graduated from that program, got their CVT and left, and not just left academia, they left veterinary medicine altogether because within a year or two, they were already like, this is not sustainable. I can't do this, and have moved on to find other careers. And, you know, when I think back younger in my career, turnover wasn't nearly the thing, at least in the clinics that I worked in. Dave, maybe you can talk to that too. But I think now people are just less willing to put up with the BS and the poor conditions and the low wages and the lack of utilization and stuff that maybe we were then, or maybe it's just highlighted and more out there now. But it's definitely something I've noticed really increase, at least in my personal experience, the last few years.
I would say probably in the first 18 or so years of my career, I worked at 2 practices that there was not a lot of turnover, but I think that's also because we were treated really well. We were respected. We were, our opinions were valued. And I don't know if it's just because since I've moved down to North Carolina, I've worked at a corporate practice. I've worked at another referral practice. I don't know if that's the cause of it or if it's just the timing of things of when I left those 2 practices up in New Hampshire down here that there was a shift in what we saw in the practices. And, you know, just speaking on turnover itself, some of the roles that I've had have been like training and education and getting new technicians up to speed. And one of the jobs that I've recently left within the last couple of years, I left that job because I was hired as an education and training coordinator. And to me, that role meant I was going to be training staff. I was going to be putting on CEs, and that was like my dream job of training and CE and teaching students, or not students, but teaching new technicians how to do some of the great stuff that we can do as technicians. And maybe a couple months into that, they're like, yeah, we need you on the floor. So my role from education and training went from that to, well, now we need you on the floor. And by the way, we're short-staffed. So there was no opportunity for me actually to do any of that training. And we get in all these new people, and me as the training person, when do I have time to do that when I'm swamped with ERs and swamped with the ICU. Like, when do I have time to do any of that stuff? And I think that that probably led to a lot of the turnover at one of the practices I was at, because they didn't feel like they were taken care of because the person that was supposed to be taking care of them was under 4 or 5 ERs and 6 triages and in an ICU full of patients. Like, what was I supposed to do?
Yeah.
And eventually that's why I left, because of like, you hired me to do your job and you're not letting me do the job. So I have to find something different.
I think we have almost, it seems almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy or like chicken or the egg situation, where it's like, you know, I kind of mentioned feeling like steeled against that turnover because it breaks my heart every time it happens. But I feel like I know it's going to happen for various reasons. And I think that's a problem. You know, I almost wonder, like I said, the self-fulfilling prophecy of like, oh, they're gonna leave anyway.
Right.
So tell me more about the, you know, I stayed at this practice for a long time because we were paid and we were respected. Like, what was that like? What do we need to be doing differently to not have this continuous cycle that is clearly, you know, dysfunctional for everybody?
Right. Yeah. It's a really excellent point you make, because I believe sometimes that's the mentality, like, they're just going to leave. Like, we know that shelf life, quote unquote, of technicians is 5 to 7 years. So why make an investment to try to make that, to extend that shelf life? And Dave, you can talk about this too, but the clinic I worked at in Southern California, I think I was there for 12 or 13 years before I moved to New England. It's where I got my VTS. If I wanted to go to a conference, I just asked the practice manager. She sent me basically all expenses paid. You know, doctor came out of the room, wrote the orders. We did everything. You know, there wasn't, you know, which I thought was pretty standard. And I would see posts online about, you know, the difficulties people were having in clinics. And I was like, man, I'm not experiencing this. And then I came to realize I was actually working in one of those unicorn clinics that everybody kind of talks about. So they do exist, but at the same time, like, how do we break that cycle of, you know, just getting, whether it be practice owners, practice managers, corporations, whoever it is, out of that mindset of, well, they're only going to be here for a short time, and into the mindset of, well, if we invest in them, you know, like any good investment, hopefully it will pay dividends down the road, and we can extend that shelf life by a few years and have a really great team together, you know, or a core group of people for 6, 8, 10, 12 years or more. If you create the environment that people want to stay, they'll stay.
Well, and just to jump off on the using the term unicorn clinic, I too worked at a unicorn clinic, and Jeff, you know, a lot of the people that work up there as well. And, you know, you ask what creates that unicorn clinic, and thinking back, it was, like Jeff said, using us as technicians, using our skills and valuing our opinions. And I've been thinking about this, of what makes it a unicorn clinic. And you know, when you go to a new place and you're doing your working interview and you talk to the technicians and you're like, so tell me about this place. What do I need to know? And as I'm thinking of my unicorn clinic, I would tell them all the great things about the clinic and everything about the boss. Like, the boss is a great person to work for. The office manager was a great person to work for. It was a small clinic. We were kind of like a family. And that was a great environment. And now that I think of other clinics that I've worked at since then, I say, well, this is good and this is good, but here's the other thing. And when I think about that unicorn clinic, I never had a but. There was never well, you do have to watch out for this, and so-and-so is a crazy person, and don't deal with that person. And, you know, as I've gotten into other clinics, there's always that but of like, oh, this is great. You'll learn how to do this. You'll learn how to do that. Pay's not that great. Sometimes the office manager is kind of crazy and makes you do stuff. You do have to work a lot of overtime. But overall, it's a great, it's a great place to work for. With that unicorn clinic, you never have that but.
You never have that
thing where you're like, well, maybe. And I'm trying to think right now, like, is there something that I can think of that I would say, well, you do have to watch out for this. And I can't think of that.
Yeah.
Which is what makes it a unicorn clinic.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a scale issue there? You mentioned that it was a really small clinic and you are kind of like a family. Do you think as they get bigger and bigger, maybe we run into more problems there just by the nature of more people working together in the same environment?
Yeah, I don't want to talk bad about corporate practices because I do see their value. But, you know, leaving New Hampshire, I came down to work for corporate practice. And, you know, when I eventually left there, one of the questions I had for my new job was like, how many levels of management do I have to go to get something done? Like I used the example of a syringe pump where we were short syringe pumps and I had to fill out a form and then I had to go to a committee and then the committee had to talk about it. And then the committee had to pass it on to another level and then go up to another level. And then finally, 6 months later, I get my syringe pump where 6 months later, I probably need 4 syringe pumps now. So that smaller scale, I think does play a big role in it because the doctor there, the owner and his wife knew everybody and they treated us all like family. Whereas it, in the corporate practice I worked at, when I was leaving, they said, we want this to be a family. And you know, one of the arguments against that was, well, you just fired like 6 of my brothers and sisters. So I don't see how we're supposed to make this a family unit when you're just lopping people off willy-nilly for finances.
Yeah. And Dave, the clinic I came from is a little bit different model than yours in that we were owned by a board and just had a practice manager on site and had associate veterinarians. And, but what I will say, kind of listening to your response, what I thought of is we had really strong leadership. Mm-hmm. If as you were alluded to with the syringe pump, I mean, if something broke, centrifuge broke, it was either fixed or replaced the next day. The centrifuge that we had in the ER at Tufts still has, I mean, the white tape has been changed, but it's been held together with a piece of white tape my entire time there. And why is that? Because exactly what you're saying is that, you know, it's got to go through all of these people and all of these different things. And it just, the wheels turn, but they never go anywhere. And so, you know, thinking about scale, yeah, I think those were smaller practices, but certainly not, at least my clinic. I mean, we had probably 20, 25 people, maybe even a few more on staff. But I think one thing, especially as I think about like 24-hour facilities, places that never stop, they never get a break. They never get to close their doors, turn the sign around, turn the answering machine on. Like, I think those, it's really, really hard for those kinds of places to, you know, if there's a fundamental problem, if there's something that needs to be fixed staffing wise or whatever, I think sometimes it's really, really difficult to get a hold of because there's never a pause button.
Well, and just, I don't mean to keep going on and on about this clinic that I worked at, was one of the things that happened that is such a stark contrast from working for a private practice and working for a corporate practice. There was one day that I took a phone call from a client and the boss was working along with us. So he was there that day. And this woman was going on and on about, she was just yelling at me. She was swearing at me. And the boss was sitting next to me on another computer. And I said, Kevin, can I hang up on this woman? And he didn't ask what was going on. He said, yeah, go ahead, hang up on her. Because he knew that if I was asking that something bad was going on. And he did not tolerate clients treating his staff that way. And he said, if they come back, we'll deal with it. And contrast to that, in the corporate practice I worked at, we had this one client that was terrible to the receptionist, terrible to the staff, terrible to the technicians, not to mention his dog was a jerk. And he had all these demands every time he came in and he demanded special treatment. And he was a nightmare to deal with. And turns out this person was actually a life coach, which made us think, how is this person a life coach?
That explains so much.
Well, can't control his own life and gives us all this crap. And thinking back to the clinic that I worked in New Hampshire, that person would have been fired as a client, like instance number 2. And this was going on years of this person being terrible to staff. And there was an actual meeting to say, should we fire this person, and pros and cons. And there was like, I don't know, there was at least 10 people at the table, like doctors, technicians, managers, CSRs, all that stuff. And I'm like, and this was very early on in my corporate career. And I said, guys, I'm not really understanding this because in the clinic that I used to work at, we would never be at this state. We would never get to the point where we have a meeting on whether or not we're going to fire somebody. and I gave the example of somebody called and browbeat me over the phone about something that was completely unrelated. And the doctor said, go ahead and hang up on them. Whereas here we have to have a meeting on, are we going to tolerate this person treating the staff this way? And I don't mean to place such a emphasis on how bad corporate is and how good private is, because I do realize that both of these things have their value. But just making that a unicorn clinic is taking care of your staff and having their back and being on their side, instead of saying, well, this person's being terrible to all of us, so let's talk about it first before we get rid of them. And I'm trying to think, I don't think they actually fired that client.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, kind of goes right along with it.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Dr. Cassie, kind of along those lines, like what did you have any training in school about how to deal with those, how to navigate those kind of situations as a veterinarian? Like, you know, what do you do if you're in the situation with an irate client, like
conflict resolution?
Do you felt like you got a little bit of that or no?
So, yes and no. We did have some training just on client communication, and they would kind of walk us through talking to a client. If I'm remembering correctly, we did this a couple times throughout a semester. We did, kind of periodic trainings. It wasn't, I don't want to speak incorrectly, but I feel like it wasn't like a whole big class on how to do this. And I think a lot of the focus was on our communication with the client, not necessarily vice versa. Like, what do you do if the client comes back at you and is irate and is creating this big situation? More so like sitting in an exam room with a video camera and are you asking open-ended questions?
Sure.
And stuff like that. Sure. So no, we went through some stuff on, you know, what if you make a medical mistake and communicating that to a client correctly, but I don't think there was a lot in terms of conflict resolution. And I feel like I'm hearing a lot more stories now, 2020, just these really difficult clients being a more regular encounter. I don't know if it was quite as pervasive. I graduated in 2014, which wasn't a super long time ago, but in 2020 seems like quite a big departure. So maybe these are a little bit more pervasive now, but I don't know. That could just be my perception.
Yeah.
Could be. Well, and just, I mean, you mentioned 2020. I mean, added stress. I mean, it's stressful for everybody, but us as essential employees or essential workers or whatever they're calling us, you know, we don't have the ability to say, okay, well, we're just going to take a break because COVID's going on. We still have to go to work. We still have to do all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cassie, you brought up the point a little while ago, and it's something I kind of want to go back to because it kind of feeds into a lot of this stuff. The difference between or the usage of correct titles like veterinary assistant versus credential technician. And, as I said, even in my time at Tufts, I saw assistants promoted to veterinary technicians who had not gone to school or had not taken the VTNE or satisfied the Massachusetts requirements. I think that's, even though the school isn't necessarily going to spend time training veterinary students on what an actual CVT is, kind of as an unintended consequence of that, they are training veterinary students that it's okay to hire veterinary assistants and call them veterinary technicians and so on and so forth. And, I was an alternate route student in California. So we basically had this law that you could, if you had enough in clinic experience, you could combine that with a lesser education component. You still had to go to class, but it was less classroom hours. Combine that with your experience of a couple of years, and then you could take at the time, it was California did not have the VTNE. We had our own state exam. So I went that route, and then we adopted the VTNE a few years later. And so I have taken that. But as an alternate route student, there's still probably three dozen states in the United States that I can't get licensed in, even though I'm a CVT in Massachusetts, I'm an RVT in California still. but I can't get licensed in a number of states because I'm not an AVMA accredited school graduate. But there's so much variability there, just in our own profession in terms of title, but the delineation between the two, I think is really starting to, I mean, it's been kind of rolling for a little while, but I think that debate is, or that idea or that discussion is really starting to heat up about appropriate title usage. And I think, again, that feeds back into pay, that feeds back into utilization, that feeds back into turnover, so many things we've been talking about, but I think that's another facet of it.
I think that's a big problem with this. You know, we look at this whole technician thing as a big issue, and there's so many different facets to it, like we've talked about, but we typically can't fix one without fixing another. And we can't get to the goal without fixing all of them. There's not a way to fix, I don't think there's a way to fix one individual thing. They're all interconnected, and it's very hard to do all that.
Yeah.
I think agreed. That's one of the big problems with this.
Yeah.
Yeah. My husband and I were having this conversation yesterday, and, you know, I was talking a little bit about, you know, our conversation and some conversations I've had recently, and we were trying to solve all the problems, and you're exactly right. Sure enough, as soon as we solved one, it created another one, and they are all interconnected. It seems like to me that if we're going to change anything, we need to do it, and it's going to be painful, and it's there's no way to move forward in a way that's going to address these issues that isn't going to hurt in some way. And so we kind of just need to know that that's going to happen and go forward anyway and try to make things better for everybody. And as veterinarians, you know, we need to be an ally. We of course, you know, have stake in these issues, but we want the people that we work with to have job satisfaction and longevity. And so, you know, how do we help? How do we do good things? And I think you guys have hit on a lot of good points as far as utilizing technicians. And I will say that's an area that is very important to me. I really like my staff to be involved and not to feel like warm bodies or glorified animal holders. But I also don't want to cross that line of like, well, isn't this your job as the doctor? And so that can be a tough spot to be in as a vet of like, oh, if I ask this person to do that, are they going to think I'm trying to like shirk my responsibilities? And I think where I've gotten with, you know, in my roundabout way of getting there is a lot of communication on all sides, you know, DVMs, credentialed technicians, veterinary assistants, practice managers, and getting everybody's thoughts out on the table and trying to move forward, even just with baby steps. You know, we're not going to make huge leaps forward right away, but we can't just stay stagnant because there's no easy way forward.
Absolutely. At some point we have to rip off the Band-Aid and just go for it. And, you know, hope we get it right and what have you. But, you know, you brought up a good point there about utilization and what have you, and keeping that conversation going. And, you know, sometimes I think almost you have to inspire your staff to, or your coworkers or whoever, to want to do new things. Like we get comfortable knowing what we know and doing what we do. And that's a comfort zone. And sometimes like we have to push past that boundary a little bit and say like, I really think you can do this. Like let's try it a couple times. And, you know, just again, continuing to like build our groups up, build the collective group up and keep pushing forward. And, you know, every clinic is always going to operate a little bit differently. But again, if you have good communication, you have a good structure, you have good people, like continue the investment and continue forward. And as we talked about, like knowing what is allowed in the state in which you live in terms of what technicians can do or can't do, whether that, you know, maybe they can do dentistries, maybe they can pull teeth by law, maybe they can suture incisions or do different things. Like some states that's really clearly defined, some states it's really not. And what maybe where those gray areas lie and then what your level of comfort is, but I encourage anybody listening, like, know your state laws, know where responsibilities lie and what people can and can't do, and work within that framework. And I think you will start to have a much, much happier staff, probably even a much happier clientele, because things will run more efficiently. And, you know, we move that stone a little bit more in that direction, one little bit at a time.
Yeah. And just touching on the utilization, you know, I've thought about what makes a good team. And that's where all the team members are all working towards the same thing. And, you know, so often, you know, I've worked in, and Jeff, you've worked in very busy ERs, and you've got 3 patients, 4 patients, 5 patients lined up that all need catheters, all need IV fluids, all need x-rays. And kind of going on the opposite side, or contrasting what we've been saying about tech utilization, is that if we have that situation, and something that really makes me feel like I'm part of a team is when I get done with one and I come back and I say, okay, let's get started on the next one. And then I find out that, oh, Dr. Jeff has already placed the catheter. He still needs help getting the fluid set up. But being part of that team, obviously we want as technicians to be able to do all this stuff, but there are going to be times where we don't have time to do that all in a timely fashion. And in just getting doctors to understand that, yeah, they're going to be giving us all the orders. And sometimes they give us orders for 2-3 patients at a time, and not realizing that all these things do take time. And sometimes we do need help, because historically we're always short-staffed. But just having doctors be a part of the team instead of just being the ones that say, okay, here's your orders, I'm going to go sit at my desk and type up records. Being involved in that and understanding that sometimes we are swamped to the point where we can't get the stuff done that you want us to get done. Obviously don't take away stuff that normally we can do, but if we are swamped to the point where we can't get stuff done, getting someone to step in and help out is just super helpful. Yeah. And it makes us feel like we're part of the team. And when I've had doctors come in and say, I'm going to place this catheter, or give these subq fluids, or do this while you're doing all these other things, never am I going to say that's my job, I should be doing that. Because if I'm swamped to the point where I'm backed up, I mean, that takes stress off of my mind of just having help, in making us feel like we're part of the team, and making us feel like the doctors are part of the team, instead of, I don't want to say it's an us versus them, but having it be that dynamic of doctors are the bosses and technicians are the subordinates. Having a team cohesive unit, I think, is really helpful. Yeah. And there are a lot of doctors that do actually do that for us, which is really helpful.
Yeah, agreed.
I'm so glad that you said that, as far as like being part of a team. So I heard a couple things in what you said. It sounds like ultimately it's a balance. It's a balance mm-hmm. between letting you do your job, but not when you're so swamped, you know, not failing to jump in when the technical staff is so swamped that they can't get it all done, you know, still being willing to jump in and pitch in. I will tell you, I could not agree more with you as far as the team approach. I feel so strongly about that, and everybody looking at this patient, looking at this case, and offering their opinion. One of my biggest pet peeves is if I say, you know, hey, what do you think about this? And somebody looks at me and goes, I don't know, you're the doctor. I'm like, so I automatically have all the answers? Like, no, I'm only one person. I'm only human. You know, I've been a vet since 2014. So, you know, 6 years, a little bit over. You guys have been in the field for 25. You've worked with multiple different doctors, and you've seen lots of different cases and different approaches to things. There's a lot of value to be gained from that team approach, and just everybody putting our heads together and coming up with the answer together. We get better patient care, we get better client service. And then, you know, the other part of it too is if there is that team approach and everybody's involved, it frees us up as veterinarians, because that client doesn't always come back needing to talk to the doctor. You know, they're just, yeah. they just want to talk to a team member right. because they have faith in everybody who's involved in their dog or their cat's or chinchilla's care. So yeah, having that right. team. Yeah. I'm not personally with me. I would definitely be one of you guys that would have the care of that one. But no, I just think it makes life better for everybody if we all work together in that sense.
Well, I've had doctors do that thing of like, what do you think? And I'll say what I feel, or, you know, give my opinion of what I think is going on. And if I'm wrong, I want them to tell me, no, it can't be that because the heart rate isn't elevated or something like that. Use those things as learning experiences. I mean, mm-hmm. you as doctors are looking for answers. You're trying to figure stuff out. But as technicians, you know, that's going to make us smarter and more part of the team if you include us in those decisions. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, the decision is yours, obviously. But to just have us use our brains to say, oh, I've got an elevated heart rate. I've got an elevated temperature. Maybe this dog's in pain. Maybe it is in various stages of shock or what have you. But just being able to utilize our brains, because, I mean,
yeah.
Granted, Jeff and I have been in the field for quite a long time. We have a lot more knowledge and experience, but even those younger technicians, you know, if they've got even just a little bit of experience, they can kind of talk their way around things and figure stuff out. And if they're wrong, that's a learning experience for them. We've always said that being a technician, once you get through school, once you get your VT&E passed or your VTS passed, you are not done. There's still tons to learn. I often tell my students and my coworkers, I'm like, I don't know anything. I don't know everything. That's not a myth. It's a myth you need to stop telling people because there's so much more knowledge for us as technicians and even you as doctors to learn stuff. Like I feel like every single day I go to work, I should learn something.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I will say, even if we ask for an opinion and it's not on the right track, what I've found is, you know, even if that's, you know, completely not where this case is going, it gets my wheels turning in a different way. So it changes my perspective on the case. So even if that's not the answer, it still helps me get to the answer by just changing my perspective on what I'm seeing. So yeah, I think there's a lot to be gained from that roundtable discussion and everybody using their brain to figure out an animal, not just, you know, oh, well, you're the doctor, so you have all the answers. Because I promise you that's not the case.
Yeah. You know, one thing I've heard a lot through the years, especially about technicians, and maybe this applies to veterinarians as well, is that once we have acquired a certain level of either, whether it be knowledge or skill level, we hoard that. Some of us hoard that and don't pass that on. Don't teach or you know, keep things to ourselves almost as like a job security kind of thing. When you have this team idea, if you have, you know, 6, 8, 10 people, whether it's one veterinarian and a bunch of staff or a bunch of veterinarians and a bunch of staff kind of problem solving this case, so many different people have so many little different areas that are their niche that, you know, this person over here might be like really, really strong and really love dentistry. Somebody else might really love ophthalmology. And like, you can really lean on those people and not have to have one person have all of those areas. And so, you know, I know, again, like I said, it's been kind of long out there that some technicians, and I'm sure, again, this applies to some veterinarians as well, that we just kind of hoard our knowledge and not, whether we're embarrassed to share it, whether we don't want to share it, but share it, allow it to become common knowledge so that the next time that thing happens or that case comes in or what have you, everybody is better prepared for it. And then you can, you know, start to problem solve with other things that maybe you couldn't figure out because it doesn't matter your credentials. It doesn't matter how much school you had. Like if you have valuable contributions, make them, make your voice be heard.
I am opposite of hoarding my skills. and I'll tell a story that happened recently, within the last couple of years is, I really like transfusions. I really like setting that up and figuring all that stuff out and doing all that stuff. And I was fairly new at this job, so I was coming in with a lot of knowledge, and a lot of the technicians that I was working with didn't have a whole lot of knowledge on transfusions. They just kind of followed along with what the doctor told them to do. And then I come along with all this passion for transfusions and knowledge about it. And I got a call at a baseball game, day off at a baseball game. Dave, how do I do this transfusion? So sharing that knowledge, not hoarding that knowledge, gives me the opportunity to not have to be on call all the time for all those things.
Yep.
Happens with central lines too. Like I've worked at some clinics where I would come in the next day and we've got a DKA patient that didn't have a central line in, and they're poking it every 2 hours for a blood draw. And I'm like, why does this patient not have a central line in? And they said, well, nobody knew how to do it. I'm like, well, why does nobody know how to do it? Why didn't somebody ask me to show them how to do this? Because this patient would have been so much better off with a central line in it than you poking its lateral saphenous vein every 2 hours for the last 12 hours. So I am against hoarding skills and knowledge, because the more you spread that knowledge and more you spread those skills, the less I have to do.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And not that I don't want to do anything, but you know, there's a lot of things that I do in my role. And you know, if I have to stop X, Y, and Z that I'm doing to do the one thing that only I know how to do, like how is that benefiting?
Right.
I mean, and it benefits everybody, like having that knowledge out there. It benefits
the
patient, it benefits the client, it benefits the team as a whole. And like you said, and it benefits you personally, because it takes some of that burden off of your shoulders.
Yeah.
This job is a huge responsibility. There's so much to do all the time. There's so much on all of our shoulders all the time. Like spread it out, spread the load.
Yeah, for sure.
Going back to the team.
Right. Yeah.
I think the whole scenario of this entire discussion should be teamwork.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's the only thing that's going to get things done is teamwork.
Yeah. Yeah. So ideas, how do we make some of this stuff happen?
Oof.
Well, you know, I'll say one thing that I've heard in this is I kind of mentioned earlier that whole, it can be painful to make an investment in somebody because there's this kind of, you know the lifespan typically in the veterinary technician field to say like, oh, I'm going to, you know, pour my heart and soul into this person. And they're not only going to leave my clinic, but they're going to leave the field entirely. And that can be hard to do. But it sounds like we need to make that investment anyway, emotionally, time, knowledge, financially, and make that investment in people, because we're still going to lose people. People are still going to leave the field. We're not going to change it overnight.
Right.
But if we can get a few more to stay in and a few more to stay in, and then maybe we can start improving things as a whole, then maybe we can change that narrative in the long term.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think when we've probably all heard in 2020, with everything that's going on, seemingly clinics are busier than they've ever been. Everybody is being pulled 12 different directions at one time. Their caseloads are up. I have a real, real hard time believing that clinics are not making at least as much money, if not more, than they previously have. Actually analyze your income and see if you can make an investment in your team. And then that includes yourself. You know, if you're the practice owner, if you're the practicing veterinarian, whatever it might be, like that investment includes yourself. I would be hard pressed based on what I've heard about how busy clinics are. And I can certainly think of my time at Tufts. I mean, we absolutely were. But yet it seems even with as busy as clinics are, we're almost paring down or minimizing resource utilization and holding on to money even more than we previously have. And why? Like all that is doing is really furthering the problem and not working on a solution. So I would encourage people to really look at, if you really believe you're busier this year than you ever have been, then you should be making more money than you ever have been. And if you are, what are you going to do with that? Because that's going to speak volumes to your team. And even if that's, you know, whether that's investing in new equipment, replacing old equipment, technicians get a huge rise out of a new piece of equipment to play with. Yeah. Same with doctors, like a new, you know, a new surgery tool, an upgraded phone system, like whatever it is. Like investing in the practice is not just investing in the people. It's also investing in the infrastructure of the practice. And so kind of like look at that as well. Bring yourself up, you know, get new blood machines, whatever it might be. There's a number of ways to do that. But I feel like if you actually can say you feel like you're busier than you ever have been, you should have more disposable revenue to invest in your practice and invest in your people and invest in yourself.
Well, I think we also, in order to stop turnover and increase retention of technicians, just speaking on technicians right now, but just thinking about how to keep technicians, how to keep good technicians in your practice is you have to incentivize it. You have to say, okay, you're going to start out at $14 an hour. And if you complete this task, this task, this task, and you show us that you're going to be working your way towards a leader, then we're going up to $14.75, and have a clear path of that. Not
right.
You're going to get raises potentially after every whatever it is, the first 90 days, we'll talk about getting you a raise. Have a plan in place. Don't just dangle the term raise. You're going to get an increase. Great. Yeah. What is that? What am I working towards? And then suddenly you get an increase in, let's say it's like a 2% increase. So now you're making $14.25. Great. Awesome. I made another quarter an hour. But incentivize that and put a clear path for technicians of, if you stay here this long, this is what's going to happen. And this is how you're going to benefit from staying that long. And not just money, not just financial incentives, but days off. I mean,
yeah,
and days off and forcing, I don't want to say forcing, but requiring that people use them, because, and then here we go, this is going to circle back around. We have to fix that by, we can't tell people to take off when we're short staffed every single day. Like, how are we going to say, okay, Tiffany can't work today because she's got her scheduled day off, which means that only one person is going to be on the floor today, where normally we're going to have three. So you have to incentivize it in a way that's sustainable and mapped out.
Yeah,
I feel like here's what you're going to get year one. We're going to increase your pay to such and such, like an extra dollar an hour if you complete all these tasks and show us that you're working your way towards this goal, instead of just saying we're going to give you an increase at some point.
Like,
that's great to hear, but then when I hear that, what am I going to say? I'm going to say, okay, when is that going to happen?
Right.
What do I have to look forward to?
Right.
And I will say, even going back to the Unicorn Clinic that I worked at, there was one year, as I was getting further and further on, they said, we've had kind of a down year. I can't afford to give you a raise, but what I am going to do is I'm going to pay for all of your medical insurance this year. So, you know, just doing the math in my head, like, that paid for a raise. That's less right. money taken out of my paycheck. And it probably worked out, you know, tax-wise with the owners. But instead of saying, we don't have money, sorry, we'll try next year. He did something, you know, right. he did something to show value and show that there is a path for me. There is something for me to work towards. And you know, I feel like if I was still working there, I'd probably be making $4 or $5 more an hour than I am now.
Right.
But you know, I hate snow. That's why I moved to North Carolina.
I'm with you there.
You bring up a really good point, Dave, because I think when I was younger, when I think back to my early days as a technician, again, you know, $5 an hour, at that time, 16, 18 years old, all I really cared about was what my paycheck was.
Yep.
Now at 42, and knowing that, you know, from a pay perspective, we're largely topped out in this profession, I care less about the dollars per hour and more about the benefits. And so, as you were kind of alluding to, having like some kind of tiered setup where, you know, as you reach certain benchmarks with a certain practice, at 5 years, we are going to increase our match of 401k from 2% to 3%. At 7 years, it goes from 3% to 4%. Like, after your fifth year, you get an extra week of paid vacation. After your seventh year, you get, you know, have those kinds of things set up that actually make people want to stay. Because frankly,
the reality is, at some point, $1 an hour for a year, that's $2,000 gross. That's not going to make a difference at some point, being the only thing keeping people there. There's going to have to be other things, and that's going to be benefits. I've seen hospitals offer gym memberships. I've seen hospitals offer, you know, supplemental insurance like Aflac, like really outside of the box things. And when you can't really put a dollar sign on some of that stuff, but as you said, like in a year when maybe things are down and they can't offer you that raise, if you happen to hit a milestone that year, if that's your fifth year or seventh year, and you get an extra week of paid vacation, or you get some extra PTO, or whatever it might be, like that's ultimately, especially as in my, and from my perspective, as you advance in this career, that's what's going to keep people long term, not a dollar an hour raise a year. Like,
yeah.
It's how are you going to be set up for the rest of your life, and offering 401k and offering, you know, some of those kinds of more long-term goals, to me now, 25 years in, is far more important than what, you know, I used to think about just a paycheck back then.
Yeah.
Kind of treating people like they're going to be in the field for a long time.
Right. Yeah. Right. I'm
setting up a plan that is conducive to longevity.
Yeah. One of the veterinarians I know from back home, I worked with him in emergency, and he opened or bought a general practice, and it's a thriving general practice. Like, it's a really, really, really great facility. And he was one who really invested in his staff. But for every staff member that hit 10 years, all expense paid vacation to Hawaii.
Oh my gosh.
And now granted, now that's a very extreme example, but he knew what the value of having people in that practice that clients saw every time they came in, the same faces, the same voices on the phone. He understood the value of that. And, you know, I remember a couple of years ago, now his practice is probably only, I'm going to say 15-ish years old at this point, but he's already sent 3 people to Hawaii.
Wow.
And that's like, I mean, again, that's an extreme example. Not everybody has that budget, but that's something that is going to keep people. Like, if you're at 7 years, like, man, I'm going to hold out 3 more years and go to Hawaii before I leave this place. Like, whatever it is, like, you know, and again, you don't just have to do that for yourself, for your staff, do that for yourself, like incentivize yourself as well as a practice owner, or a practice manager. Like, anyway. Yeah.
Well, and also just thinking about the structure and the levels, a lot of the practices that I've worked at, they have like, you know, you start off, you get 40 hours of vacation time. If you're there for 2 years, it goes up to 80 hours. Then at 5 years, it goes up to 3 weeks off. And then after that, usually there's nothing, because they don't expect us to be there that long.
Right.
They haven't factored in that if your practice is great and people want to stay there, you may have people that are there for 10 years that want to do some of that stuff. Like, I can count probably on one hand the number of technicians that I know that have been in a practice more than 10 years.
Right.
A couple of them have been on our show, and, you know, a couple that I've actually worked with, the general practice I worked at, there's a couple of technicians there that have worked there 20 plus years. But that's so rare. It's not very common for technicians to be at one practice for that long.
Right. Right. And I think about my time at Tufts as well. I mean, I was only there for 4 years. I frankly, especially at this point in my career, I couldn't see doing it long term. But there are a number of people that have been there either approaching or past 20 years as well. And I know it's not the pay. I know it's the benefits. You know, it's the academic calendar, and it's working for the university and all of the benefits that has come associated with that. And again, at some point in everybody's life and everybody's career, like, it kind of starts to shift a little bit more that direction. And, you know, again, incentivize it. You know, at 3 years, we're going to pay this much of your health insurance. At 5 years, we're going to pay this percentage. And again, you know, I think that is exactly the type of investment that I'm talking about. Like, why is 5 to 7 years the shelf life? Because, Dave, as you just said, most practices only have plans, in terms of a tiered system, for 5 years.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, and it's hard to plan for something that long when, I mean, like we've said, you've got two people there that have been there 20 years. I know maybe three or four other people that have lasted longer than 10 years. It doesn't really make sense for them to make that plan because, I mean, it's going to happen once or twice ever, right?
Right. But that's just, I think that's just having the hope or having the desire for that to be the system. Have a plan in place. If nobody ever hits it, nobody ever hits it. But
yeah, but we talked about the self-fulfilling prophecy earlier.
Right. Absolutely.
So change the narrative, make a different self-fulfilling prophecy and, act like people are going to be around for the long term. And you won't get everybody, but maybe you'll get some.
Yeah.
Well, and then that practice you talked about, Jeff, that's the practice that sends technicians to Hawaii.
Right.
So that is something that, you know, right now I'm like,
that's a good job to get.
I think I could.
Yeah. That's a good job to get, you know, like.
Sure. You get a reputation out there for being somebody who takes care of staff. Yep. I'm so glad that we're putting all of this out here. Like I was just sitting here listening to you guys talking and I'm like, man, I feel like, you know, I've got the cheat sheet here to hear a lot of what's going on and causing a lot of dissatisfaction in the field. And so I'm glad that we're going to be putting this out there. I mean, everybody needs the cheat sheet or at least the beginning version of it to say, we've got something we need to change. I think that there's been enough conversation in various aspects to say it's not going to be simple. It's not going to be easy. Like you said, we fix one thing, we break another. So we're just going to have to break some things. And let's break some small things in the beginning.
Right.
But let's start moving forward because now that we've pretty much come to the conclusion that it's not a simple fix, then we're just going to have to start doing something.
Right.
So thanks for giving me the cheat sheet on all of this stuff. Tell me more.
Well, I mean, the hard part of this is that we're technicians. Like we're underpaid technicians. We don't have a big stake in the game of how to change these things within large corporations and large practices. And it's just getting a voice out there and getting more than just us to be on board with this, to kind of push this conversation forward.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, for some of these things, Cassie, you said earlier, you use the term, veterinarians need to be allies for technicians. I couldn't agree more because a lot of this change, at least for our profession, is going to have to come from the AVMA where veterinarians are the only ones with seats at the table, because a lot of this is going to have to be national movements or you know, national rules changes, legislation, and obviously not the financial stuff, but in terms of you know, titles and different things, like we are going to have veterinarian alliance to work with, you know, their agency, the AVMA, so that we can work with our agency and NAVTA to really try to make some of this stuff happen. And again, I know this stuff doesn't change overnight. Like the wheels of government turn very, very slowly.
Especially now.
I mean, I feel like, you know, Dave, the episode we just recorded with Liz Houston, she said she felt for a while like that something big in the veterinary industry was coming. And I mean, I really think if we're not already there, we are rapidly approaching a critical mass in this field. And we need to take action. And it's going to take, you know, new ideas, new people. It's going to take, you know, people getting out of their comfort zone and taking a role in some of these things or being active in some of these things. Like, honestly, who wants to go to AVMA board meetings? But you know what? They're public. You can attend. You know, I when I live in California, I go to every California Veterinary Medical Board meeting. And a lot of times it's like literally watching a car fire on the highway and nothing gets done. But that's how we move the technician position, the profession, like one degree forward, like show up to the meetings, share your ideas, let your voice be heard. And I get it. Like it's boring. It's a day, it's whatever else, but if we don't have the conversations, nothing is ever going to happen.
I agree with you about the critical mass. And I don't know exactly what that's going to look like. I don't know if we're here and this is what it looks like, or if there's something more coming, but there's a lot of just difficulties in every aspect of the profession for a lot of different reasons. And I think things that we can improve on going forward, and you know, it's it's not going to be there. There's nothing where you can say, oh, well, you know, we're going to change this and this and this and this, but maybe we're getting to the point where we can at least start having these conversations and everybody come to the table and be honest about where we're at with things in order to better the profession as a whole and keep moving forward, not just stay stagnant in that, well, it's always been this way. You know, you just got to work yourself to death for no money and
until you can't take it anymore. Yeah.
Right. Until you leave the field.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I wonder if we could have like, I mean, this is, I know we're talking about baby steps and I'm thinking huge, massive picture. I wonder if there's some way, and it may have to involve NAFTA of some sort, of just having a roundtable discussion or a meeting of technicians, of the technician field, and have representatives from every state, different regions of the state. I want to say like a Congress, but like a group of technicians that are part of organizing and making these changes. Like how do we organize and get to the point where we can go to the AVMA, go to these different entities that are going to be controlling some of the things that we're trying to create change with? How do we get that organization to get a clear path of what we want? And you know, we talked with Liz Houston about unionization, and I don't know if that's involved in it, but how do we get on a national level some of these ideas out to the people that are capable of making the change? Where, you know, we're just talking about it. We're starting this conversation, and I don't know if it's just, I don't know what's the term, imposter syndrome. I don't know if it's just imposter syndrome thinking that I'm just Dave. What can I do to make all these changes? Like, how do we get to a bigger level to make these changes? Like, where do we go from here? Yeah. Like, we're getting these ideas out. We're talking about them. We're discussing them. But how do we get them to the next level where change can actually happen? That's my big question.
Yeah. And it's one I don't have an answer for.
Yeah.
No. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, something along the lines of the Veterinary Technician Association and stuff like that. But you guys would know a lot more about that than I would. The other thing I think is we need to be realistic about our expectations in veterinary medicine. I mean, there's no doubt that many of us who go into this field and we're in it for the long haul, there is some sort of a calling or whatever you want to call it. You know, our hearts are in this field. Personally, for all of its flaws, I love being a veterinarian. I love being in veterinary medicine. But I also think we need to be realistic that we can't just all show up out of the goodness of our hearts for the rest of our careers. You know, we have families to support and bills to pay. And, you know, we want time to ourselves to do things outside of veterinary medicine. We want to have hobbies and lives and stuff like that. And so instead of kind of taking for granted that, oh, well, it's just this calling and veterinarians and technicians and everybody alike are just going to continue to show up no matter what, because we have this calling, it's not realistic for the long term. And I think we're seeing some of that now. Yeah. And so getting that message across of, yes, of course, there's a part of it where our hearts are in it, but we still have to make it a sustainable career field.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, did we solve it? Did we fix all the problems?
I'm ready for another 25 years.
Jeff, another 25.
Oof.
Like you said 10 years and I get to go to Hawaii. I'm like, I don't know that I got another 10 years in me.
Oh my goodness. No, we're so happy to watch you guys for as long as we have. Don't let us lose you now.
I mean, I think that was some great discussion. And honestly, I mean, I would 3 months, 6 months, a year down the road, whatever it is, I would love to have another discussion.
Absolutely.
And look at what we talked about today. And are we still having the same early or rudimentary discussions of it? Or has anything actually happened? Are there any new ideas out there that we can discuss and continue to, you know, hopefully move this thing forward? Because again, frankly, like I say this partially tongue in cheek, at least I feel like, you know, at 25 years, like in terms of clinic work, my best years are behind me. I want to leave it a little bit better for them coming along. You know, I didn't really recognize many of these problems until I hit, you know, year 15, year 20, whatever it was. I'm hoping that people that are getting in there now, you know, in 10 years, if they make it that long, or 15, that it's better than what it is now. We've kind of somehow gotten to this point. Hopefully we can get it a little bit better so that our respective professions, both for DVMs and for veterinary technicians, are, it's better. Some point down the road, it's just better.
Well, and just putting this information out there and continuing to recognize that there are these things that need to be addressed. I mean, it's 2020. We have technology and social media, and the world has shrunk around us in that we can reach out and communicate with each other. Right. Hopefully just, you know, continuing to put that information out there will engage more and more people to where we can all work together and move forward.
Absolutely. And I also want to say too, you know, as some of these discussions unfold, whether it be in podcast forum like this or in Facebook discussion groups, be nice to each other. Like, no idea is not worth discussion. Everything, you know, whether it pans out to be a good idea or a bad idea, it still warrants discussion and thought. Like, let yourself get uncomfortable, let yourself be vulnerable, let yourself actually like think about things in a new way, because that's where change is going to come from.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Get outside of your comfort zone. Yes, a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I'll tell you, I love to take these conversations, and this one absolutely is along the same lines, and walk back into a clinic setting afterwards and say, okay, this is the conversation I had. This is what I gathered from the conversation. Where are you guys at? You know, tell me your thoughts on this. And there is some discomfort there, both on my part of, mm-hmm. you know, feeling like I'm kind of putting myself out there to this might not be positive feedback that comes back.
All stuff they've been wanting to say, but just haven't.
Yeah, like open the door. All right, guys, let me have it. But also, you know, on the staff's part to say like, oh, what do we say? Like, you know, what's right. safe and okay. But once we get that conversation going, I mean, just on a very small scale in a single clinic, I feel like I've had some great conversations and gotten a lot of insight from the staff just of that one clinic. And so if by putting this out there, we can open the door to say, all right, listen to it. And then just start having conversations with each other, veterinarians, technicians, practice managers, everybody. And let's talk about it and see where we all fall on the same page. Like you said, hear novel ideas, get uncomfortable and see where it all falls.
No, and I will say that, you know, I realize we're in, I don't know what the lockdown status is where you are, but that this would be a conversation to not have at the clinic. This would be a conversation to go out, have drinks and say, guys, let's talk. Because in the clinic, there's that thought of like, why are you asking me this here? Why, like who told you to ask me this stuff? Is there a management part of it that's wanting you to go in there? I think when you get people out of their comfort zone and out of the work environment, they're more open to saying, look, this is what's going on. Just between you and me, this is what I want to tell you. Whereas in the clinic, you may get an edited version of what they're really thinking.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's just my personal experience. That's and having a couple of drinks always helps to loosen up the lips a bit as well.
Absolutely.
No, I think that's great advice to make sure everybody's in a situation where they're comfortable and isn't looking for the catch of, all right, if I say this, then what's going to happen?
Right. Yeah. And then suddenly like 2 weeks later, so Dr. Cassie spoke with us about what you said the other day. And then they're like, oh crap, I shouldn't have said anything.
Oh shoot.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I've actually known situations, fortunately, I've not personally been involved in them, but I've known situations where those kinds of things have happened. And then it just, there's no conversation after that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Realizing that now you can't really just go out to a bar to have that conversation.
Right.
Exactly. Is a Zoom beer date?
Yeah. Well,
something like that.
I mean, we've
Jeff
done
and I've done a couple of those. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Absolutely. Yep. Jeff, I was looking at your sweatshirt there and I have a wine glass that says, I just want to drink wine, Sabian.
Yes. Nice. Well, I've had a lot of fun today.
Yeah. This has been great.
Absolutely.
I've thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. What do you think? Should we quit while we're ahead? And
took the words out of my mouth.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out, everybody, and chatting about all this stuff. I hope to do it again soon.
Yeah, we should definitely do this again soon. Probably, I don't want to say after COVID's over because we don't know when that's going to
right,
be.
Right, right.
But at some point.
But at some point, at least check in and see, you know, events, see what's changed, if anything.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
That's always the plan, right? When we treat patients, right? Initiate a treatment plan and evaluate patient response. Like,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's, ever the technician, Jeff. Ever
discuss technician. Some ideas and evaluate the response.
I love it. Well, yeah, let's definitely plan to have this discussion again in the future. And like you said, see if we've moved the needle even a little bit.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Awesome.
Cool. All right.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Hey, caffeinators. We would like to thank you for listening to the Vet Tech Cafe podcast today. As you guys are well aware by now, we often talk about difficult issues that face our profession, and we chat with colleagues and leaders in our field who have strong opinions of these issues. Those opinions expressed by either Dave and I as the hosts or those opinions expressed by our guests are their opinions alone and do not represent any other person, any other business or institution or any other entity with or within the scope of veterinary medicine. If you have any questions relating to this, please feel free to email us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. You can check out our website, vettechcafe.com. And please, whatever podcast form you're using to listen to our episodes, like us, follow us there, like us and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. And lastly, have a great day, caffeinators. You guys are awesome. Bye, guys.